After the disaster of 9/11, many people had a new concept of heroes. The policemen, the firemen that ran into the burning buildings to rescue the people that were in peril were the heroes. And it wasn't long after that before our president declared a war on terror, and our military were our heroes. But that was very short-lived. And that causes me to ask two questions. The first is, who are our heroes today? Who are the people that we really admire and look up to, if it's no longer our rescue workers or the people that defend our country? I think for some people, the heroes are those wise guys, those quick guys who figure out ways to cheat the system. I don't understand why crooked politicians get elected year after year after year, except for the fact that they're bringing money back to their state by whatever crooked dealings they're involved in Washington. This seems to be enough to satisfy the people. We get something out of it, and so we don't care about the moral fiber of the person. He's our hero. He gets something for us. We have a television show called The American Idol, well named, because we idolize our talented people, those who can sing and act and athletes and so on, and those are the individuals that for many of us are the heroes. And oh, we wish we could sing like them or dance like them or whatever it is they do. And we think they are so special and they're so wonderful. They're the heroes. Or maybe it's some fictional character, the tough guy in the movie who can fight and can shoot and get the girls better than anyone else can. And he's the hero, and all we admire him would like to be like him. Who are our heroes today? That's the first question. The second question is, have they changed? And I mean that in both ways. Have the persons we've admired changed? Or have we started to admire different persons? And the answer is probably yes. There's some changes. The heroes that your children have are not the heroes you had, and the people they think are impressive are not the people that you thought were impressive. Most of you are well aware that I grew up without a father. And so my heroes were Superman and the Lone Ranger. And there are several reasons for that. One was they were completely good. There was no bad part about them. Secondly, they always saved the day. They rescued the victim. They defeated the bad guy. They solved the mystery, and always within 30-minute episode. I admired that. And they were humble enough not to seek any praise for what it was they did. At the end of near every episode, the Lone Ranger would kind of give an elbow to Tonto, and the two of them would jump on their horses and start riding off while the others were talking, and the guy would turn around and say, "Where'd he go? I wanted to thank him." "You'll never have to thank him. He's the Lone Ranger," and off he rides. And I admired that, too. But then someone came along and decided, you know, that's corny. And we need to have heroes that are more like real people. And so we started coming up with heroes that would cuss a little bit and would fornicate periodically. And would break the law a little bit in order to accomplish a greater good in their estimation. And so our heroes started to be different kind of people, more acceptable to us, more identifiable to us. And what happens when you lower the quality of your heroes? Well, then you lower the quality of all those people that are looking up to those heroes, don't you? And the average man drops in his caliber as well as the heroes do. Understand, as we're talking about this, that heroes don't have to be imaginary. There can be real guys that are heroes. And they will have flaws. But those flaws will not be the thing that is praised about them. We will not admire David because, well, he got Bathsheba in the bed. That's not what we're admiring him about. We're not admiring him for some flaw in his character, but for the goodness of him. They will have flaws, but those flaws are not the thing that we praise. And they will fail, but it's not for lack of character that they fail. It's not because, well, we know he always goes out and gets drunk on Friday night, so we can't expect him to save the day on Saturday. No, there's something else that caused him to not be successful in his endeavor, but it's not anything wrong with his character. In fact of the matter, our heroes should be those who faithfully follow God in whatever situation they find themselves. Those are the real heroes. People that are doing what God would have them to do. And we can think of a couple of Old Testament heroes that come to mind. And the reason these guys come to mind are various. But I think of Elijah for one. And one of the reasons we think of Elijah as such a hero is because of the powerful adversaries. When the hero has a big bad guy against him, it makes him a greater hero. Superman had Lex Luthor to fight against all the time. And so that made him a more powerful hero because he had such a powerful villain to fight with. Well, Elijah had Jezebel. And there isn't anybody worse in humanity than Jezebel. And he was the one who was selected by God the time to fight against her. Also because of the great battles that take place. Wyatt Earp is famous. The OK Corral episode. And so we have the battle that took place with the Baal contest for Elijah, where he stood against the prophets of Baal, 400 of them. And we're going to see which God can light the fire under the bullet that was sacrificed. And of course, the true God could do it, and the Baal worshippers could not get Baal to do it because Baal was nothing. And Elijah consequently becomes the standard. He's the prophet by which all other prophets are measured. He's the one who is representative of the prophets. When Jesus was in the Transfiguration, it was Elijah, the prophet, that stood next to him. Nobody else. And then we can look at Moses also as a leader who often comes to our mind, and because he was a leader of the nation. He led out maybe 6 million people out of Egyptian bondage. What a great leader he must have been. And great works he did, not only all the plagues that took place in Egypt, but also parting the Red Sea. And wouldn't it have been an amazing thing to be able to do that? I heard, and I don't know if it's true or not, that Universal Studios used to have a parting of the Red Sea that you could go and see at their theme park. That was when I was younger. I don't expect they have it anymore. Now they have much more modern things from more modern movies, but I always wanted to go see the parting of the Red Sea, and never did quite get to that. Maybe some of you have, and you can tell me about it. And Moses was one of kind. He was not the standard of lawgivers. He was the lawgiver, and the only one God had in the Old Testament. And so these men we look about as heroes, but I'd like to consider some other person and consider why he should be considered heroic as well. We're going to make a comparison briefly of two individuals in the Bible and ask yourself, who was more heroic, Jeremiah or Jonah? Jeremiah, who preached locally to the people of God in Jerusalem, or Jonah, who preached to a foreign nation, Nineveh? Our definition of heroes are usually somebody who comes from somewhere else. You know, Superman came from a planet far, far away. And so he can come here and he's different and he can be our hero. Or the gunslinger who rides into town from who knows where. But all the guys who are local, who are always here, they're nothing special. Jesus said a prophet's without honor in his own town, you know, and that's the kind of the way it is. And so maybe you don't think of Jeremiah as quite as heroic as Jonah, because Jonah went to a faraway land to do his work, whereas Jeremiah was just kind of a local boy. Also consider that Jeremiah converted no one. We don't have any record of anybody turning their lives around and straightening themselves up because of the preaching of Jeremiah. And yet when we look at Jonah, he converted everyone in that city. He walked in there, he preached to them, and every one of those people turned around and submitted to the will of God and repented of their wickedness. What a man Jonah was. Jeremiah also was rejected by all the people. Well, surely if he was any kind of quality hero, somebody would have accepted him, somebody would have admired him. He'd have a little bit of a following. Indiana Jones did, you know. Shouldn't he? Whereas Jonah was accepted by all the people from this foreign land that he went and preached in. We could go on to say that Jeremiah was trying to save a city and that city was destroyed. He failed. Of course, on the other side of that, Jonah wanted the city to be destroyed by God, but God spared it. So I guess he failed too. Jeremiah wept over the failure. He's known as a weeping prophet. And how many of us say, real men don't cry? And so Jeremiah, you're just out of it. You're not one of those guys. Whereas Jonah had the more masculine emotion. He was angry when the city was spared that he wanted to be destroyed. And so he was angry over his success while Jeremiah wept over his failure. And the final thing, Jeremiah obeyed God immediately. Whereas Jonah disobeyed God initially. Now you may have a different idea of who is more heroic in your own mind, but I think Jeremiah was actually a greater hero and did a lot more than what Jonah did, and yet we don't think of Jeremiah usually as heroic because of the circumstances of his life. And that's something that I think we need to change. Primarily because you and I try to emulate and imitate our heroes. And if we have the wrong concept of what a hero should be, then we're going to be working in the wrong direction. We're going to be seeking the wrong goals. So I'd like to consider a few verses from Jeremiah. If you have your Bibles, go ahead and open to Jeremiah chapter 1. We'll make just a few references here, then the lesson will be yours. Jeremiah chapter 1, we start with, we find that he is called into preaching to be a prophet as a young man. In Jeremiah chapter 1, beginning in verse 4, "Then the word of the Lord came unto me, saying, Before I formed thee in the belly, I knew thee. And before thou camest forth out of the womb, I sanctified thee, and I ordained thee a prophet unto the nations." And I think that's a good argument there for opposing abortion. God knew who Jeremiah was before Jeremiah was ever delivered, which means he was alive and well and understood by God. He was what God would call life, and therefore we ought to oppose abortion. Continuing on, verse 6. "Therefore said I, Lord God, behold, I cannot speak, for I am a child. But the Lord said unto me, Say not, I am a child, for thou shalt go to all that I shall send thee, and whatsoever I command thee, thou shalt speak. Be not afraid of their faces." Now, why would God tell him that? I believe this is suggesting that these people are not going to be terribly receptive for what it is he has to say. You know, I go and do a gospel meeting, nobody ever tells me, don't be afraid of their faces. When I stand up to preach here, nobody ever says, don't be afraid of their faces. Because nobody's really anticipating I'm going to be met with a whole lot of opposition. But he is being told, you're likely not going to be appreciated for what it is you do. "Be not afraid of their faces, for I am with thee to deliver thee, saith the Lord." And understand, when God says, I am going to deliver you, he's not saying, I'm going to make your life comfortable and easy. What he's saying is, you're going to be victorious. Ultimately, you are going to win. "Then the Lord put forth his hand and touched my mouth, and the Lord said unto me, Behold, I have put my words in thy mouth. See, I have this day set thee over the nations and over the kingdoms to root out and to pull down and to destroy and to throw down, to build up and to plant." Jeremiah had a full range of activities he was supposed to be involved in. And when you think about the rooting down and the pulling down and the cleaning away the rubbish and so on, recognize people aren't going to like that. People want to leave things the way they are, and they're not going to be very happy if you want to go about changing what it is they're used to and what they're comfortable with. So Jeremiah has been given an assignment that is not likely going to be well received by the people around him. In fact, we're told that the people will oppose him. Verse 17, chapter 1, Jeremiah. "Thou therefore gird up thy loins, and arise, and speak unto them all that I command thee. Be not dismayed at their faces." Why does he say that? Because they're going to be in opposition to you. "Lest I confound thee before them. For behold, I have made thee this day a defensed city, and an iron pillar, and brazen walls against the whole land, against the kings of Judah, against the princes thereof, against the priests thereof, and against the people of the land, that they shall fight against thee, but they shall not prevail against thee. For I am with thee, saith the Lord, to deliver thee." Most of us don't like confrontations. We would not go somewhere if we knew going somewhere we're going to meet somebody who's going to be our enemy and is going to resist what it is we're trying to accomplish. We say, well, maybe somebody else ought to go and do that job. I think I'll go somewhere else where I'd be more warmly received and accepted. But Jeremiah is selected by God to go out and face these people that are going to oppose him. We read in chapter 16 and verse 2 that he was not supposed to take a wife or to have children in this land. The land of Jerusalem was defiled. The people were wicked. He was not supposed to marry somebody. He was not supposed to produce children and be responsible for a family. And I can think that that might have been a good thing for Jeremiah's potential family. But it must have been awful hard for Jeremiah himself. I told my wife I was going to preach on heroes tonight. She says, "Oh, you're going to talk about yourself?" Because she says, "Because you're my hero." And I don't know how well I would do in anything if it was not for her standing with me. And my children have often called me their hero. And it just chokes you up inside when you think somebody's looking up to you like that and you're not quite pulling off what it is you would like to do for them. But that's part of the reality that we have to deal with. But Jeremiah did not have the wife to compliment him. He did not have the little shining faces looking up at him and saying, "Daddy, we love you. You're doing all right." He had to make it without that. He had to keep going without that support. And he had an unpopular message, if you'll turn to chapter 7. Chapter 7, beginning in verse 1. The word that came to Jeremiah from the Lord, saying, "Stand in the gate of the Lord's house and proclaim there this word, and say, Hear the word of the Lord, all ye of Judah, that enter in at these gates to worship the Lord." So he's standing in the prominent position. They can't get around him. They got to hear what he has to say. And everybody who's coming in to worship, he's going to address them. He's going to tell them what it is God has said about them. And so it's not kind of like, "Well, I'll just worship at the other church down the street." He's at the temple. They're going to have to see him and listen to what he has to say. Verse 3. "Thus saith the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, amend your ways and your doings, and I will cause you to dwell in this place. Trust ye not in lying words, saying, The temple of the Lord, the temple of the Lord, the temple of the Lord are these." Basically what they're saying is, since we have God's temple, we know that God is going to protect us and nothing bad is ever going to happen to us. We're His people and we're taken care of. Jeremiah's saying, you've got to amend your ways. And stop thinking because you can walk into this temple that you're approved of by God. You've got to examine yourself and make some changes, or God is going to take this city away from you. It's not going to be yours anymore. Verse 5. "For if ye thoroughly amend your ways and your doings, if ye thoroughly execute judgment between a man and his neighbor, if ye oppress not the stranger, the fatherless, and the widow, and shed not innocent blood in this place, neither walk after other gods to your hurt, then will I cause you to dwell in this place, in the land that I gave to your fathers forever and ever." Of course, the opposite of that is true as well. If you continue to do these sinful practices, I'm going to take this land away from you. If you don't amend your ways, I'm going to toss you out on your ear. God is telling them that you are not going to be able to continue on what you're doing and be successful in any wise. Verse 8. "Behold, ye trust in lying words that cannot profit." There are a whole lot of people that will preach what it is people want to hear. They will say exactly what tickles your ears, what entertains you, what excites you. But those same lying words are going to condemn you. And so Jeremiah has positioned himself in a position where they've got to hear this undesirable message. Because if the city is going to be saved, that's what it's going to take. Verse 9, "Will ye steal, murder, and commit adultery, and swear falsely, and burn incense unto Baal, and walk after other gods whom ye know not, and come and stand before me in this house, which is called by my name, and say, We are delivered to do all these abominations?" In other words, that God has blessed us and provided for us so that we can keep on sinning. We know God approves of us because we've done His temple, because we got the city of Jerusalem. And so it doesn't matter whether we burn things to Baal. It doesn't matter whether we oppress the fatherless. It doesn't matter whether we steal from people and give bad judgments. God has delivered us so we can practice all these sins. That was the mentality these people had and the lies that they were being told by other prophets. He says in verse 11, "In this house which is called by my name, behold, a den of robbers in your eyes. Behold, even I have seen it, saith the Lord. But go ye now unto my place, which was in Shiloh, where I did set my name at the first, and see what I did to it for the wickedness of my people Israel." Now you recall that Jeremiah is talking during the period of the divided kingdom. The northern group, Israel, had been taken away into Assyrian captivity.
And Shiloh was the place where the tabernacle was originally set up. That was God's original portable temple, if you will. And he's telling people, you go over there and look at Shiloh and see what it looks like. Because the northern group, Judah, has not yet been destroyed or taken into captivity. And so they're thinking, we've got the temple and nobody can touch it. Shiloh was once God's place too. And look at it now. Because the northern tribes were not faithful, they were taken away into captivity. And the same thing is going to happen to Judah, the southern tribe, that city of Jerusalem as well, unless they make some changes. In verse 18, he says, the children gather wood, and the fathers kindle a fire, and the women knead their dough to make cakes to the queen of heaven, and to pour out drink offerings unto other gods, and they may provoke me to anger. What Jeremiah is telling us here is this is a family affair. We're all united in this. We all have our responsibility toward our idols. You do this sinful behavior, I'll do this sinful behavior, we'll bring it together so mom can do her sinful behavior, and we'll offer it up to the idol. And they're all in cooperation with the activity. Have you ever seen that within the Lord's church? Where somebody will condemn the fact that a child is playing baseball instead of going to worship services, and then the parents will defend it. And then maybe the grandparents will come in and they'll justify it. And maybe the preacher won't say anything about it because it's his kid who's going out and playing baseball when he ought to be there working. And on we go, seeing the disintegration of the family, and everyone in the family is a part of the problem. This is the kind of populace that Jeremiah had to face, that he had to deal with. You know, it's a wonderful thing to be able to preach the gospel. I've got a whole book full of ideas that I can draw sermons from. And I can pick topics that aren't going to make anybody mad. And I have a diverse audience. Not everybody here is contaminated, you know. I can say some things about people that need to repent. Not everybody's going to get hit by that. And some people are going to pat me on the back and encourage me and say, it's a good thing. We appreciate that. Some people may get mad, but they're not going to be everybody. But Jeremiah had an entirely contaminated audience that he had to speak to. And he had a specific message God told him to say. And it wasn't popular. And it wasn't going to be well received. And he didn't have any option to say, well, I'll preach on something else. But he had to deliver what it was God gave him for that particular group at that particular time. The results were not favorable. In Jeremiah 20 and verse 2, we find that he was put in the stocks. As he moans about his own situation in 20 verses 7 through 9, he says he's mocked every day. And he speaks as if he didn't really understand this is what it was all about. You know, and he kind of got the idea that God would help him through this thing, and it wouldn't be quite as difficult as it turned out to be. And he thought maybe he'd just keep his mouth shut, and then he said, the word burned within me, I couldn't. And so I have to preach the message, but everybody's going to beat up on me every time I do. He said, this is not really a pleasant experience I'm going through. In chapter 32 and in verse 2, he was tossed into prison. In chapter 38 and verse 6, we find him put into a dungeon where he sinks into the mire. 38:6 says, then took they Jeremiah and cast him into the dungeon of Malchiah, the son of Hammelech, that was in the court of the prison. And they let down Jeremiah with cords. And in the dungeon, there was no water but mire. So Jeremiah sunk in the mire. That doesn't sound like a very pleasant experience, does it? People won't go down there that low themselves. They lower you down with cords, with ropes, because they don't want to get down in that stench. But they lower you right into the middle of that stuff, and you sink as deep as you're going to sink in that. And stay in that environment. There were death threats that were put forth against Jeremiah. When King Zedekiah says, I want you to talk to me and tell me what the word of the Lord is, Jeremiah asked him, are you going to kill me after I tell it to you? He had the idea that people wanted to kill him, and there were some that wanted him dead because he kept saying what God told him to say. And then after Jerusalem was finally destroyed, and Babylon set up a governor in Jerusalem, the people assassinated that governor. And then they feared and thought, we better run away to Egypt. And they asked Jeremiah, what does God say we should do? And Jeremiah says, God says we should stay here. Well, they said, no, we're going to Egypt. And they went and they dragged him with them.
He was not treated well at all. He taught the people to repent of their sins, but they refused to do so. Therefore, the destruction of Babylon came closer and closer, the destruction by Babylon to the city of Jerusalem. Then he got to the point where there was no chance of the city being delivered anymore, and so he told them to surrender. Maybe we'll save some lives that way. Still wouldn't listen to him. Don't want to follow what it was he says. And then after the city was destroyed, he told them, we're supposed to stay here. They go, nope, we're running off to Egypt. Every time he talked to them and told them what God said, it seemed like they did the exact opposite of what it was he told them they were supposed to do. And I find it fascinating that the person that seemed to have treated Jeremiah the best out of all these people was the captain of the Babylonian army. The guy who came in and destroyed the whole city and killed all the people and burned all the things and destroyed the temple. That guy came to Jeremiah. In chapter 40 and verse 4, and now behold, I loose thee this day from the chains which were upon thine hand. If it seem good unto thee to come with me into Babylon, come, and I will look well unto thee. But if it seem ill unto thee to come with me into Babylon, forbear. Behold, all the land is before thee. Whither it seemeth good and convenient for thee to go, thither go. He says, you're a free man. You can come to Babylon and I'll take care of you. You can go somewhere else and that's fine with me. You want to stay here, that's all right too. You do whatever you want to do, Jeremiah. Nobody's going to touch you anymore. As long as you have a Babylonian guard there to take care of you, that is. So Jeremiah was treated well by this individual, releasing the chains that his own people put upon him. I want you to understand that Jeremiah was not a failure. He was not a loser because he didn't accomplish what it was he would like to accomplish. He wasn't a failure because he cried. He was not a failure because the people died. But yet he probably felt that way very much himself. Is it a greater hero who succeeds and continues because he succeeds, or doesn't get the job done and then keeps on trying? Which takes greater strength? To keep going when things aren't working the way you would want them to? What takes greater strength? To do some good things and somebody encourages you, or to keep doing good things and nobody supports you? Which one takes greater strength? Does it take greater strength to see everything you love destroyed and still keep on doing what is right instead of giving up? Or to see everything come out just like you want it to, and then you do well? There's an old story about called The Man of La Mancha, a musical about an individual named Don Quixote. And within that musical is the song The Impossible Dream. Don Quixote was an individual who was elderly in age and imagined himself to be a great and powerful knight. He would go out and try to fight windmills, thinking they were dragons, and all sorts of other things in his life. And basically everybody looked at him as some kind of nut. But he kept on doing it. He kept on fighting against the bad guys, even though he wasn't making any headway. At the end of that song it says, the world will be better for this. That one man, scorned and covered with scars, still strove with his last ounce of courage to reach the unreachable star. We don't keep going because we're successful. We don't keep going because we're necessarily going to make it. We keep trying because that's what God said we're supposed to do. And that's what a true hero is. Someone who's faithful to God. A true hero is an individual who recognizes success may not come in this life at all. I may have thousands of Bible studies without converting an individual, but I'm going to keep having those studies. I may go to millions of hours of worship services and never be accepted as a strong Christian, never be admired by somebody else, but it doesn't matter. I'm going to keep on doing what God would have me to do, regardless whether there's any sense of success or progress in this world. As long as I'm getting closer to heaven, I'm going to keep on going. Because that is really where justice is. You may never receive it in this life. You may never be appreciated as a hero here.
But when you get to heaven, God will accept you, and that will make it all worth it. If you're here this morning and you're not a Christian, we hope that you'll reconsider what it is you're doing with your life. Maybe the problem is that you are admiring the wrong sorts of people. I wanted to talk about Old Testament heroes because we go to the New Testament, we have one hero, Jesus Christ. He was perfect. He never did anything wrong. He never said anything wrong. And He is the one we're supposed to emulate more than anyone else. Although we're always going to fail in trying to do so, we're going to keep on trying and keep growing closer and closer and closer to being like Him until eventually we reach our goal of heaven. We hope that your desire is to follow Jesus. We hope that your desire is to be a hero in God's sight. And if we can help you in order to accomplish that goal, we pray that you come right now while we stand and while we sing.